Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello, movie truthers. Welcome to this week's episode of Truth and Movies. I'm Michael Leader.
I'm Hannah Strong.
And I'm David Jenkins.
And today we'll be talking about Kelly Reichardt's Divine and Bovine First Cow, the devilish origins of Cruella, and in our film club, we're heading back to 2008 for Kelly Reichardt's Tale of a Woman's Best Friend, Wendy and Lucy. All coming up on Truth and Movies, a Little White Lies podcast. Yes, hello listeners, and Hannah, David, welcome to this new revamped version of Truth and Movies. Hannah, how have you been?
Good. Time is still like a flat circle to me. I have no idea, kind of, even with like getting back to going to the cinema and things, I still can't quite get a handle on time. Mm-hmm. But yeah, good. Glad to be back at the cinema, glad to be back in restaurants. Happy that it looks like things are kind of going in the right direction.
You know, what we've done, we've pressed F5, we've turned it off and on again, turned it off at the sockets, re-plugged it in, everything. This is a new revamp of Truth and Movies, so we could all just reintroduce ourselves, really. So, Hannah, you're Associate Editor of Little White Lies. What do you do?
The question on all my relatives' lips. I basically kind of sit between David as the print editor and Adam as the online editor. Mainly kind of doing all the kind of reviews that we've got at the moment for online, and I don't know, just kind of picking up the slack, I guess. But at the moment that mostly involves writing a book, so that's still something that I'm talking about in the abstract, but not in detail yet, but watch this space, listeners.
Oh yeah, can't wait to hear more about that, Hannah. You'll have to go into a lot of detail once you can. And of course, David, you are the grand fromage, the head honcho at Little White Lies, right? Is that still true? Have you had?
If you say
has there
so.
Been any battle for the throne?
I haven't been fired. Just I've, you know, I've had to fend off Hannah's advances with a massive iron broadsword, but. You know, beyond that, no, nothing. No, I mean, it's been a weird year, and it's been definitely one where we've had to kind of put our thinking caps on and be quite sort of a bit more innovative than usual in working out what we're covering and how we're covering it. And I think it's something that's also given us a bit of an opportunity to sort of look like maybe sort of do some issues that we may not otherwise have done, or cover films that we may not have covered. So I definitely think that there's been some lessons learned as well, and that now that relative normalcy is kind of hoving back into view, and that, you know, Peter Rabbit's 2's box office bonanza has now sealed the fate of British cinemas, and the sunlit uplands are just over the horizon, that we, you know, I don't, you know, we won't want to just go back to the old ways. And so yeah, it's been fun, and learned lots of new things, and learned how to use Zoom, and learned that I have really bad internet.
Well, Well, long-term listeners will remember that about a year ago, you and I had a podcast that went down in Truth and Movies history as the Dad Pod, where we wondered, will we ever be able to take our children to the cinema? Will there be cinemas when they're old enough to go to the cinema? Of course, cinemas are reopened now. Have you taken your little one yet?
Well, as a matter of fact, yes. I did, like last Friday, my daughter, who is about, she's like 2¾ now. She's really into like the Peter Rabbit cartoon on CBeebies. And we were kind of wandering around and she kept seeing, I mean, this is a really amazing kind of marketing test case. She kept seeing the Peter Rabbit adverts on buses and screaming, going, look, Peter Rabbit, let's follow that bus and or get on that bus. And I was like, well, and this is in combination with a children's book she had called Maisie Goes to the Movies, which is about a little rabbit who goes to see a movie. And that combo just kind of came together, and I just thought, to hell with it. We're going to go and see Peter Rabbit 2 on a Friday matinee. It's going to be chill. It's raining outside, so it's perfect time to do it. And yeah, she was totally locked into the world of Peter Rabbit and Donald Gleason's pratfalls and everything. So yeah, it was a heartbreaking experience, even if the film itself was shoddy, I would say. But we're not here to talk about Peter.
No, we're not, of course. We should mention as well that there is a new magazine on shelves, new issue of Little White Lies, a couple of weeks ago now that it was launched, but the first time we can talk about it on the podcast. Who wants to do the honours? Hannah, do you want to introduce the new issue?
Yeah, we were very excited to be able to finally do a Kelly Reichardt issue. It is the first Cow issue of Little White Lies.
Yeah, I'm not directly on the payroll, and I can say with all my heart it's a beautiful issue, really well put together, an amazing deep dive into all things Kelly Reichardt, First Cow, amazing baking on display throughout the issue as well in there. And a special shout out to, I think, one of the all-timers in terms of the covers, amazing design, and then embroidered by Stephanie Watts as well. Shout that out. But of course, the issue is about First Cow, which is in cinemas this week. And we're going to be talking about that. That's the lead film this week, as well as the new big Disney film, Cruella, that's also going on Disney Plus. And then we'll have Kelly Reichardt again in Film Club with Wendy and Lucy. So let's kick off with First Cow. So up first is First Cow. In the 1820s, a taciturn loner and skilled cook travels west to Oregon Territory, where he meets a Chinese immigrant also seeking his fortune. Soon the two team up on a dangerous scheme to steal milk from the wealthy landowner's prized Jersey cow, the first and only in the territory. So, David, Kelly Reichardt has been excelling for years, but because I think this is an A24 production, because MUBI are releasing it, this seems to have got a bit more of a push than her last few. Could you quickly introduce us to Kelly Reichardt's vibe and how that feeds into First Cow?
Yeah, she's someone who I got into in, I think it was 2006 when Old Joy came out. I think I was into Will Oldham. Like the music, you know, music of Palace Brothers and Bolly Prince Billy. Then, like I See a Darkness was like one of my faves, as it probably is most people's. So there was that was definitely a hook seeing Will Oldham act, but I think that the push came from a friend of mine in the industry called Francis, who worked for a company called Soda Pictures. One of their earliest releases was Old Joy, and this was like I knew her, and this was kind of her big labor of love. I think she was kind of like quite young in the industry as well, so this was her first big project, and it was like very meaningful for her. So it was quite, you know, I was invested in it before I'd seen it, because she'd kind of, you know, it was a kind of hype thing, but yeah, I remember seeing it and loving it, and interviewing Kelly Reichardt and Daniel London, who's the main guy in it for the London Film Festival, just being one of those people whose career I'd followed. I was really upset that I couldn't go to Cannes in 2008, I think it was, because Wendy and Lucy was playing in The Uncertain Regard, and that was like the film that I was most interested in seeing the reaction to. But because it was on that kind of lower non-competition tier, not that many people were seeing it and writing about it, but there were a few, you know, underground things saying, oh yeah, this is amazing. So I was really excited about that. And yeah, she's just someone who I've met, like, I've managed to see her films at festivals, and they've all just been really interesting. Sometimes I've felt like that there's been a couple of her later ones, like Meek's Cut Off and Night Moves, where, like, definitely it was a kind of second viewing where it hit the hardest, because, like, I think, you know, I think one of the things about her films, and I think it definitely covers First Cow as well, is that there is a sort of deceptive simplicity to them. They seem like they're just kind of guys and women out on the landscapes, and they don't say much, and that sometimes they don't really do much, but you know, I think there's like that when you kind of like pull back the fabric a bit, you can see the stitching, and it's really kind of complex, and you know, that there's so much kind of, I think that a lot of her films have like this richness underneath them, and there's kind of, they're talking about bigger things and bigger themes, but she I think what makes her a great filmmaker is she's not like they're not like obviously there, you know, they're not kind of, you have to really dig for them a bit, you know, you have to kind of, and you know, she's not someone who's going to affirm what you're saying is true, or what she, you know, that you can kind of impose things on the films, and everything kind of fits, really. So she's very kind of inspired by like the kind of new Hollywood 70s filmmakers. They're quite kind of, you know, there's sort of Americana vibes to her films, and you know, that tradition of kind of character actors and you know, looking at working class people in a very kind of heightened dramatic way, and you know, things like poverty and landscape, and you know, things that mm-hmm. you don't really see as much more in mainstream cinema, but and yeah, like, you know, First Cow feels in many ways like a kind of urtext for the Reichardt hardcore.
You said that Kelly Reichardt's films don't immediately seem to be about anything, or at least don't kind of stun you with this high concept in the way that mainstream cinema does. I did a bit of an experiment in the last year, so I didn't go to Berlin where this film premiered, and of course with the way the last year worked, this film had a very sort of protracted pre-release phase, and just judging by the promo materials, we know there's a cow in this. Literally the titular character is a cow, and in the production stills we have like one bloke or two blokes and a cow. That's all I knew about this film going in. I knew I'd love it because I've loved Kelly Reichardt's films previously, particularly Certain Women a few years ago. And it is full of such delightful things. And Hannah, you need to really delve into the film in order to bring out what's good about it. But let's start with the cow. Good cow?
Great cow, yeah. I think like long-time listeners will know that I'm a very like meme-oriented person. And I think that A24 is a production company that really plays into the kind of millennial, zennial love of repurposing images and kind of distilling films to, you know, their kind of core element, which some people hate that, and they're entitled to their opinion, but I think it can also massively work in the film's favour. And it's very interesting to see someone like Kelly Reichardt, who I think you would not expect to be getting that kind of treatment, have this film that's kind of blown up because people were obsessed with the cow. And I think there's a lot of people who probably wouldn't have ever engaged with the film was it not for the fact that Twitter kind of took on this cow as like a beloved symbol of kind of independent filmmaking, and everyone just really loved the cow. And this film came out in America last year, so there've been a lot of like pieces about Evie the cow and kind of delving into like her career as a cow, and you know, kind of really like latching on to that. And I think it is like kind of like emblematic of Kelly's career and the kind of things that she's like. Her films always tend to have like some thread back to animals and back to kind of the natural world. So I think it is like I find it hard to believe that she would be unhappy with that. I think it's really sweet the way everyone has really like really come to love this cow, and rightly so. You know, she's a great performer, great actress. It's not often we get many like bovine performers. It tends to be like, even in Kelly's films, her dog Lucy obviously has starred in quite a few. But I think it's nice to finally get a good cow on screen.
And is the cow a symbol? Symbolic cow, as well as a scene stealer?
I think so. I think, like, obviously the fact the cow has been brought over from England is kind of this, there's this idea of, you know, the kind of encroaching colonies on the American landscape. And also, like, the idea that he's had to bring this cow over rather than just like learn how to milk a buffalo, you know, or a goat or something is very kind of like, when you stop and think about it, it's absolutely absurd that he shipped this cow over. Toby Jones's chief factor has shipped a cow over because he misses having milk in his tea. It's totally kind of absurd. But also I think, like, really kind of, there's an underlying theme of like this kind of looking for home and like being homesick, and the idea that this man is so far away from home and the only thing he really wants is a little sort of taste of that. And there's a wonderful moment, which is in the trailer, I think, where Chief Factor is he eats a cake that Cookie and Lou have made, and he says, "This tastes like London." And I think it's very, anyone that's ever kind of been away from home for an extended period of time knows that kind of experience of tasting something or, you know, smelling something and just thinking, oh, wow, that takes me back. And I think there's something really kind of sweet about it, despite the fact that the film is often very, very sad. There is like this real kind of wholesome element. It's, you know, these two guys want to bake biscuits and bake cakes together, and there's this lovely cow who they treat with such Cookie and Lou treat her with such sort of kindness, and they're so gentle. And I think watching, like, against the backdrop of, you know, what was quite a brutal time in American history, particularly towards Native Americans and towards kind of anyone who wasn't, you know, a white British or Spanish colonizer, it's so rare to see a kind of Western which really revels in like the kind of tender moments and this idea of like being at one with nature. And I think it's something that Kelly is really, like, no matter when her films are set, she's a master of doing that and really kind of captures the idea of like being in sort of communication with the natural world, whether that's trees and rivers and plants or a beautiful Jersey cow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you say a Western there, and it is a Western in terms of its period setting, its locations. It's a very frontier based movie. All these people have come with the American dream of exploiting the land. But maybe it's a byproduct of the A24 type of promotion that it tries to present these films as this hermetically sealed product of a genius. Whereas Kelly Reichardt is in such dialogue with other films. I was thinking of The Sisters Brothers as another sort of sad but tender bromance at the heart of a Western, the sort of subplot with Riz Ahmed and Jake Gyllenhaal in that film, which Anton Patel on this podcast a couple of years ago called a radical feminization of the West, which feels like a similar thing here about getting at the softer side of masculinity. But then also, David, you mentioned in your review that it's almost like McCabe and Mrs. Miller with baking, the Rob Altman film. Could you unpack that a bit for us? Just because, to give people a sense of, if they don't really know what they're going to get from this film, what they are going to get.
Yeah, I think even McCabe and Mrs. Miller, which is the great Robert Altman film, which is about kind of colonial outposts in America and this kind of, but you know, almost like a kind of metaphor for the kind of birth of civilization and capitalism that goes sour. People are very, nobody knows what that film is. Like, you know, if you call it a Western, it's, yeah, people get up in arms about it and say, well, it's not a Western. I definitely see some crossover there. I also the thing that really, like, seeing it on the second sweep, the thing that really hit me was that it feels a lot like a kind of a more hushed version of a film. Like, it felt like it has a kind of Wolf of Wall Street / Gangs of New York vibe. There's got like a kind of Scorsese, you know, you've got these two chancers who are entering into this world, and you know, if you kind of swapped out like baking for drugs or something, or like, you know, futures, you know, like you've got there's the same kind of rise and fall arc in the film of like these guys who have kind of cast their eye on this dream of capitalist fortitude, and then it just kind of like, through reasons that are kind of in the end quite mundane, it just is completely escapes them. And you have this incredible sort of topping and tailing of the film, like a kind of almost sort of prologue and epilogue, where everything is kind of couched in the kind of, in a kind of existential way. Like, you know, we are just kind of flesh and bones, and we haven't got much time, and something very, very stupid could end up taking it all away from us. So, you know, when you're acting in this world, be wary of your own mortality. So, but yeah, it's really wonderful. And yeah, I just think it's a sort of film that's going to, I think it's maybe her, you know, maybe alongside, I mean, all her films are super, super rich, and this one's no different. I mean, it's like, going back to what Hannah said, yes, I think it kind of is probably the Reichert film that works as a, you know, that kind of plugs into meme culture the most easy, just because you've got this, look, there's a cow. But you know, I think that people are going to be surprised when they actually see the film, and it's like, okay, you know, there's more to it than that.
So, what scores would we put on First Cow? So for new listeners, this is the section where we put three scores on each film. This is in anticipation, enjoyment, and in retrospect. Hannah, I'll come to you first for your three scores.
I would say it's a 4 across the board for me. I was definitely excited about this just based on the concept, and was very kind of, what would the word be? Perturbed, I couldn't see it at Telluride, so I was glad to get the opportunity when it came to Berlin last year, just before the world kind of went crazy. And then for enjoyment wise, I think I've not seen all of Kelly Reichardt's films, but I think this is definitely kind of up there in terms of the ones I have seen. And yeah, it's one that I can happily imagine going back and rewatching. So yeah, but straight 4s for me.
And how about you, David? Although readers of the magazine will already know.
yeah, I'm sticking with my top tier 5s, 5, 5, 5. There's a little story in the review which people can read. I think it's going to go up online probably by the time this has been out, so you'll be able to read it. That just sort of talks about how sometimes you kind of invest in a filmmaker, and you know, there's part of you that kind of is working that little bit harder just to love them in the knowledge that it is there, and even if it doesn't appear in the first viewing. So yeah, that's my reasoning, really. It's contrived but sincere.
Not to knock it down a peg, but I'm definite 4s across the board for me, because Kelly Reichardt is the very definition of a rewatch filmmaker, and this is one that I'm looking forward to rewatching. I watch it on a link at home. I really like watching her films in the cinema, where you can really sink into it. So still a strong recommendation. I think we're all on the same page, strongly recommending First Cow, and you can pick up the magazine as well to go even deeper into that world of the film. First Cow is in cinemas now, and it's coming up on Mubi in July. Up next, we're going from the bovine to the canine for Cruella.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds. And they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Set in 1970s London, Cruella follows a young grifter named Estella, a clever and creative girl determined to make a name for herself in the world of fashion. One day, Estella's flair for design catches the eye of the fashion legend Baroness von Hellmann, but their relationship sets in motion a course of events and revelations that will cause Estella to embrace her wicked side and become the raucous and revenge-bent Cruella. So, Hannah, do we need an origin story for Cruella de Vil from 101 Dalmatians?
No.
Does this make the case for one?
It tries. Yeah, I mean, oh God, you can hear the weariness in my voice already. I've been trying to pinpoint for a few days now with some friends of mine where this began, where we began fixating on villain origin stories. And I can't. There was some debate as to whether or not it started with George Lucas and the Star Wars prequels, or if it started with Wicked and the kind of phenomenon that was that book and then Broadway show, which, for anyone who has been living under a rock, basically tells the story of the Wicked Witch of the West and how she became the Wicked Witch of the West in The Wizard of Oz. So, yeah, I mean, it's something that Disney, I think, have kind of been moving to capitalize on. We had Maleficent in 2014, I want to say, and now Cruella, and Warner Brothers are sort of throwing their hat into the ring with their Willy Wonka origin story, which nobody asked for. So yeah, it's just another way of kind of getting some IP spun out into another box office smash, I guess, is the intention.
Watching a film like this is one of those experiences where questions just keep filling your head. Who is this for? Why are they making this? What is the story here? There's the film starts with maybe a 20, 25 minute narrated montage sequence going through almost birth to young adulthood Cruella's story. And it's like, why are we being told all this? And I don't think the film, for me, really ever makes a case for itself. David, what was your response to Cruella in the first instance?
Oh, I didn't like it at all. I didn't like it with one caveat, which we'll kind of get onto in a bit. But I think I was watching it one of the things that was really hitting me. I mean, you've got Emma Stone, who I think is a really good comic actress, who is just wasted on this quite sort of thin single dimension character. Even, you know, a single dimension character who has two personalities. I mean, how do you even manage that? Then you've got it's just so badly written. You've also got Emma Thompson, who is supposed, you know, who is this kind of devilish fashion designer, who is the kind of our antagonist that we're meant to not like is actually good, and there's another antagonist who's really bad. Who played by Emma Thompson, the Baroness, and she's supposed to have all these kind of withering put downs, and I was trying to I'm just trying to think back. I'm not even sure there was one that hit. You know, there was one that was like, yes, that's really cool. That's quotable. That's memorable. You know, she's giving it everything, but just everyone and everything is let down by the writing. Even this weird, you know, 25-minute prologue about, you know, her birth. You know, it goes right back to her birth and her kind of childhood, and it's just like, you know, it just smacks of like, we don't, you know, this was the first, it feels like a kind of first draft. It feels like, let's just write everything out and see what it looks like. And they were like, oh, this is fine. Let's just do it. It's just, you know, everything is kind of signpost and you know, everything's going to happen, but let's not waste time on all the bad things about Cruella, such as like the weird production design where you have bits of modern London, let's shot on location in London, where you can see like, you know, most of like contemporary 21st century London. It's supposed to be the late 60s, early 70s. It's kind of like, yeah, it's meant to signal the death of rock, and you know, the you know, Cruella is punk, is Disneyfied punk. The one bright gleaming star in this film is Mr. Paul Waterhouser.
I mean, you say one gleaming star, because I think him and his canine associate really deserve a lot of the credit here. Paul Waterhouser plays the classic baddie, Horace, and he's joined by this like one-eyed chihuahua called Wink, and they have like a great double act going. I just want to film about them. I think like they're delightful, and Paul's doing his best kind of apples and pears Dick Van Dyke accent up against like Joel Fry, obviously is British, so just doing his old voice, and Emma Stone recycling her accent from The Favourite. But Paul Waterhouse is going for it. He's like having the time of his life, and I can't be angry at him for that. Like, he genuinely, I think, understands this is a Disney movie and it's meant to be kind of like silly and over the top, whereas I think everyone else was kind of going for like, you know, serious, like cool, like, oh, it's Cruella, she's, you know, she's a renegade punk icon. Yeah, she's twisted. Whereas Paul Waterhouse is just like, yeah, you've employed me to play the comedy bad, comedy henchman, and that's exactly what I'm going to do.
Well, doing his best is a very good way of putting it, Hannah. I'm trimming that back, excerpting you selectively there, because yeah, I love him and everything else he's done. He's always a pleasure to see on screen, but he's playing a role that is like so thinly sketched, and probably 10 years ago when this was first floated was meant to be the James Corden role or something, but at least we were spared that, at least. And yeah, I suppose for me, it's just such an unfocused film. At its best, it seems like it could be a villain origin story flashback from a Batman film of the 90s that somehow bridged Burton and Schumacher at the same time. It'll make a really great V&A costume exhibition, because Jenny Bevan's going to get her Oscar nomination for this, I'm sure. Done a great work sort of going ultra camp, but also everything that's great about 60s and 70s fashion. But yeah, wow, what a strange and focused film, and I must say, an absolute crime in against the art of music supervision, where it's just basically a jukebox from a 1980s pub of all of your 60s and 70s obvious rock classics.
I have said this in my review, but why would you hire Nicholas Britell, one of the best composers working today, to make a score and then just plaster over it with like the Rolling Stones, and here's some Doris Day, and here's some Nina Simone, and like great songs, but just no need for there's about 20 of them on the soundtrack. It's just too much.
Yeah, it's throwing money at it.
It actually got so stupid and annoying, where every single new scene, it was like a needle drop, and you're just like, oh my god, you know. You could see the workings, and it's just, oh, so bad.
There's one point where they use the harmonica intro from Black Sabbath, The Wizard, just literally the 30 seconds of that to go straight into, I believe, Sympathy for the Devil. And it's like, when it gets to the stage where they're throwing money at a music supervisor's budget to just get the effect of a petrol station double CD compilation, it's not right. But it speaks to something that was very confusing for me. Is it's a film in free fall, and they're just grabbing onto all of these reference points. It's clearly inspired by the sort of Harley Quinn explosion and how Margot Robbie did a good job there, sort of redefining a character and getting a younger audience by being sort of camp and evil. Emma Stone's being brought in from The Favourite. She brings across Tony McNamara, who co-wrote that, to kind of do a pass on the script. We don't really get much of the Favourite's qualities there. Same with Nicholas Patel. You only think they're bringing him in just to try and get a bit of that backbone from the projects he's worked on. None of it really adds up. But let's do the scores. Maybe a bit of a contrast from our previous section. David, what scores would you give this?
I'd probably give it a 3. I'm saying 3-2-1. I mean, 3-2-2. I'd probably watch it again for Paul Walter Hauser. One thing it reminded me of is, do you guys remember when they announced Disney Plus and there was this kind of parody account of all the weird live action Disney movies that kind of had cropped up on the service? I was watching this and just thinking, this is going to feel right at home with, like, you know, the computer wore tennis shoes and Herbie goes to Monte Carlo and all that kind of stuff. It's that sort of like not even trying live action family filler stuff that I think we're going to have forgotten about pretty quickly.
Hannah, your scores?
2-3-2. I think, you know, there's like sparks of kind of potential. You can definitely see the creative talent behind and in front of the camera, but yeah, it just didn't grab me. I think it's pulling from all these things which are just far better and doesn't really know how to use them. And yeah, I don't know who this movie is for, but it wasn't for me.
Mm-hmm. Definitely not for me either. I'd say 2s across the board. And just sort of speaks to a real dearth of inspiration in this sort of strain of Disney IP management. You can get really great people both in front of and behind the camera, but if you don't have a good idea, it's not going to work, is it? Anyway, that's Cruella, which is in cinemas and on Disney Plus Premier Access this weekend. Let us know what you think if you watch that or First Cow at the usual channels, at LDRelies on Twitter, truthandmovies at tcolondon.com via email. Up next, Film Club, back to Kelly Reichardt for Wendy and Lucy. Wendy and Lucy then. Wendy is driving with her dog Lucy to Alaska in hopes of a summer of lucrative work at a fish cannery. When her car breaks down in Oregon, the thin fabric of her financial situation comes apart and she faces a series of increasingly dire challenges. So this film came out back in 2008, and it was Kelly Reichardt's first collaboration with Michelle Williams, who would then star in many of her other films after that. So David, you were a big fan of this at the time, I believe.
Yeah, I was pretty, still am.
I don't want to spoil the story you give in your review for First Cow, but you gave this 6 stars, right?
Yeah. This was in the heady days of my employment at Time Out London, where there was a brief window where the editor at the time decided that the 5-star rating system was just not holding water for and so we started doing 6 stars. It was very funny because there were instances. I remember the film editor, Dave Calhoun, he did a review of Michael Haneke's Hidden, at which he gave 6 stars, and they put it on the poster and they had the 6 stars, but then they had to have brackets 6 stars after it as a kind of like, this isn't a typo, this is real, you know. This is one louder, you know. That was my Reichardt fandom kicking in, and I thought this movie was even better than Old Joy, and I think when Michelle Williams, who's the star, I don't think she was massive at that time. She was certainly kind of well known enough, but there was a sense of her. This was like, you know, Reichardt branching out a bit, working with a mainstream actor, bringing them in, you know, into this kind of more sort of roughhewn role of this drifter who and her dog who is just driving in a kind of old banger, arrives in a kind of very what should be a spot that she is quote unquote just passing through, which is her kind of little tagline in the film that she says to everyone. And everything kind of goes wrong. Lots and lots of little things go wrong. One thing to just very quickly mention is that this is the product of Reichert's collaboration with the author John Raymond, who's written everything apart from her debut film and Certain Women. They co-write the films, and then he has novels which they kind of adapt together, and he kind of passes the material over to her. And yeah, he's kind of known for these just very lyrical, very perceptive looks at kind of American marginalia, often in kind of, you know, slightly kind of tumble down locales. And, you know, in a way, you've got it's a kind of near realist version of Lassie. You know, it's like it uses a dog in a way that is completely unashamedly heartbreaking. And there is a scene at the end where there is a kind of reunion of between Wendy and Lucy, which I have to walk out the room. It's so touching and heartbreaking that it's just one of the toughest scenes to watch, I think. And it's the way, one of the things that I love about this film, actually, it's a very simple thing. It's just the way that Michelle Williams says the word Lucy. She says it a lot in the film. She just calls out the name Lucy, and it's kind of like, I remember seeing the film and that just echoing in my mind for like months, years afterwards. It's just properly kind of, it's like a kind of dialogue version of an earworm in a good way.
Well, as you say, it's a film of small moments. It focuses in on quite a small, specific story. I think Kelly Reichardt is the epitome of what I'd call a short story filmmaker, and Wendy Lucy is adapted from a short story from the same collection as her previous film, Old Joy. And these little moments, these little things that go wrong, or these little moments of kindness throughout, just really end up giving you that huge emotional payoff as they gather steam, as they come together. Hannah, was this a first watch for you? What was your take on Wendy and Lucy?
Yeah, I kind of had been aware of it for a long time, but never really found a kind of good time to sit down and watch it. And also, I kind of knew what happened, so I think I was putting off because the last thing I need is dog-related trauma. I can't stand films where a dog is put in any kind of peril, whether they live or die. Just that dogs in peril, animals in peril, doesn't sit well with me. So yeah, I knew I was going to kind of, I knew I would probably really like it, but I just was kind of reluctant because I thought it would also upset me, which it did, but it is a great film. And I think it's really funny that Michelle Williams, like her first on-screen role was in like a version of Lassie from the 90s.
Right.
And then she did this like kind of in her, I think it was the same year as Cynic Doki New York. So it was like kind of when she was really like making a name for herself. And yeah, it's just a really, it fundamentally, like I think Kelly Reichardt's films are, is quite a simple story, but it's told with such care and such clear like love and honesty. I think it's very hard to not get quite invested. And there's one scene where Wendy goes to a grocery store because she's not got any money, and she just wants to get some food for her dog. And there's this shop assistant or security guard, I'm not sure which he is. Oh, just the most hateful, like, I tweeted this the other day, but one of cinema's greatest villains, because he's just such a Jobsworth and such a, you know, what he does has like lasting ramifications for Wendy and Lucy, and it's really heartbreaking and so simple. But you just kind of know that to his character, it's just another day. It's just, you know, it has absolutely no bearing on his life. And I think that's something that in her films, she's really kind of good at portraying. You know, the way that these very insignificant events to one person can kind of change the whole landscape for another. And yeah, I was very taken with it. I think it's a really beautiful, very sad film. And I think that Lucy is just an absolute... To think like she wasn't a professional acting dog, she's just, you know, Kelly's dog, is crazy to me, because she's such a little star.
Mm-hmm. Such a finely detailed film. The characters are drawn so well, even for single scene roles. Will Patton as the mechanic, who is trying to, he clearly sees this woman's in trouble, but he really wants to get that money out of her, but also does present as some shred of decency. It's this conflict almost between a small town mentality of we are a nice small town, come and see us, but also our mercy only goes so far. It's really quite heartbreaking at some moments. Like she becomes friends with a security guard who lends her his phone. They become, it almost seems like he's going to become this great benefactor and then gives her some money. And it's really just, I think it looks only like $7 or something in the end. And that's what, you realise that's maybe a great gesture, but in the grand scheme of the hole that she's ended up in, means nothing. Something so heartbreaking and tragic there at the heart of it all. But that's Wendy and Lucy. David, would you recommend this as a starting point or the next point after First Cow? Great thing is it's only 80 minutes, but then most Kelly Reichardt films are quite short, so you can binge them all in a weekend, although I wouldn't recommend it that way. What do you think?
I'm pretty sure there's like a Blu-ray box set out there of all her films, and then Certain Women is on Criterion, so they're all out there and available. You should do it. I think definitely do them in order, because there's definitely a kind of sense that each one just gets a little bit more expansive in its own kind of unique Reichardtian world. Wendy and Lucy for me is the pinnacle, just because I think the thing that makes it work for me is that it's like, I think there is a sort of trope of cinema, and a lot of directors, and I think male directors tend to do this, is like they have a female protagonist and then kind of torture her and just make bad things happen to her, and the drama kind of comes from that. And I think that like one of the things that's great about Wendy and Lucy is that like it kind of toys with this sense of like, we're not like, she's not just being punished, and this isn't just fate dealing bad cards. This is the result of like bad decisions and, you know, bad planning and, you know, lots and lots of things that kind of all kind of add up. And there is a kind of, you know, it's like willing to deal with the complexity of life rather than just be like, you know, we're gonna make a woman suffer for your pleasure kind of thing. So there's this amazing scene where she's forced to sleep in a kind of woodland clearing by a rail yard, and this kind of drunk guy played by Larry Fessenden, who was in River of Grass, kind of accosts her, but nothing comes of it in the end. But it's a real, like, there's a real sense throughout the film of like, of danger and of survival as well, and you know, being a kind of lone woman in America and making that decision to want to like be out there on your own is you know, there is so much more to consider than what you may, than, you know, like the lines on a kind of economic spreadsheet that you've got, like a budget spreadsheet.
So sorry,
I went off on one there a bit.
Your passion is infectious, David. You're clearly deep in on Reichardt and Wendy and Lucy. I think I'd agree. This really, pick up that box set that has her first three or four films in, and you're going to have a whole world opening up for you. But that was Wendy and Lucy. The dog days are over. So we're pivoting from cows and dogs to a pig-themed week next week. Not necessarily enough lead film. The big film out next week is A Quiet Place Part 2, the horror movie sequel from John Krasinski. But then our second film is the documentary Gunda, a visual tour de force recommended by Paul Thomas Anderson, among others. And we thought, since we're going to be focusing in on pigs in Gunda, our film club will be Babe, Pig in the City. So listeners, let us know what you think of that film or any of the films we've discussed on this episode at the usual channels. Email us at truthandmovies@tcolondon.com or tweet us at LWLies. Hannah, David, thank you so much for joining with me for this revamped start of the new weekly run of Little White Lies to celebrate the return of cinemas. Listeners, subscribe wherever you listen to your podcast. If your podcast player of choice lets you leave reviews too, we'd love to hear from you. Thank you very much for listening. Watch the skies. We'll be back next week.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.